coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A Bangkok shrine where a bombing killed at least 22 people has reopened to the public as Thai authorities continued searching for a man they view as the prime suspect and has possible motives for the attack. Monks led prayers and residents left flowers and other tributes Wednesday at the popular Erawan Shrine, the site of Monday's attack in the heart of the Thai capital. That also left over 120 people wounded. Grainy security camera footage appears to show a slender young man with shaggy dark hair and a yellow shirt leave a backpack under a bench and calmly walk away from the scene shortly before the blast. Authorities say that the man is likely the bomber, but have not ruled out others that might possibly be involved. Police in Istanbul have arrested two people after shots were fired near the city's Dolmabahce Palace. There are no reports of casualties in the attack near the popular tourist destination. Also on Wednesday, eight soldiers were killed in the southeastern province of Sirte. The bombing has been linked to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party. Ankara began a military offensive against the Kurdish rebel group late last month, ending hopes of a peace deal with the group. Human Rights Watch leveled harsh criticism Wednesday at Egypt's new anti-terrorism law, saying the measure has an overly broad definition of what constitutes a terrorist act and leaves Egyptians open to stiff sentences for things that may amount to civil disobedience. Among the act's provisions are punishments up to death for forming or leading a terror group, a life sentence for financing terrorism, and jail terms for inciting or preparing to incite attacks. This is VOA News. Russia sentenced an Estonian security officer to 15 years in prison for spying. The lawyer for Eston Kover, who told reporters a regional court in the western Russian city of Pskov handed down the ruling Wednesday, finding Kover guilty of spying, arms smuggling, and violating border regulations. Estonia called for his release, as did the European Union. Speaking to reporters in Brussels Wednesday, EU foreign policy spokeswoman Catherine Rae condemned Russia's actions.
Mr. Kover's abduction and subsequent illegal detention in Russia constitute a clear violation of international law. Moreover, from the very beginning, Mr. Kover has been deprived of the right to a fair trial. There was no public hearing of the case. The Estonian consul was not allowed to be present at the hearings, and Mr. Kover was deprived of adequate legal aid. So, despite repeated requests and contacts have been held at different levels with Russian authorities and Estonian authorities, the Russian authorities have failed to resolve the issue.
Russian media said Kover will be sent to a high-security, hard-labor prison in Russian territory and will also be fined the equivalent of about $1,500. Donald Trump, the leading 2016 U.S. Republican presidential contender, has ignited new consideration of an old idea, ending the country's nearly 150-year-old grant of citizenship to anyone born in the United States. The billionaire real estate mogul says birthright citizenship remains the biggest magnet for illegal immigration. He wants to amend the U.S. Constitution to revoke its 14th Amendment that declares that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are U.S. citizens. Amending the U.S. Constitution is difficult, requiring both chambers of Congress to approve any changes with a two-thirds vote, and then at least 38 of the 50 state legislatures also have to approve it as well. The well-connected owners of a warehouse that exploded in northeastern Chinese port city of Tianjin last week used their relationships with officials to obtain apparently fraudulent safety licenses, according to state media. The corruption allegation, which surfaced Wednesday, is likely to prompt further outrage over the explosion, which killed 114 people and injured hundreds more. German lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a $95 billion bailout package for Greece, a move that would help Greece meet Thursday's deadline to repay international creditors. Greece needs the money from international creditors by August 20th, when it must repay about $3.5 billion in debt to the European Central Bank. The Eurozone decision saved Greece from default on those debts and helped to avoid its exit from the single currency Eurozone.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up at this hour on African News Tonight.
In commemoration of World Humanitarian Day, international agencies are paying tribute to the thousands of humanitarian workers who have lost their lives or been injured in the line of duty.
That's reporter Lisa Schlein in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And the International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more on a ruling today by appeals judges at the Hague-based court.
Thank you, Madam President. The situation in the Republic of Kenya in the case of the prosecutor versus Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta.
The appeals decision refers to whether Kenya obstructed evidence that International Criminal Court prosecutors say they needed to build their case against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Presiding Judge Sylvia Fernandez read the decision that concludes trial judges made mistakes.
The appeals chamber finds that the trial chamber erred in the exercise of its discretion by conflating the non-compliance proceedings against Kenya with the criminal proceedings against Mr. Kenyatta, by failing to address whether judicial measures had been exhausted, and by assessing the sufficiency of evidence and the conduct of the prosecutor in an inconsistent manner.
President Kenyatta had been charged as an indirect co-perpetrator in violence following Kenya's 2007 election, but last December, ICC prosecutors dropped charges of crimes against humanity against him, accusing the Kenyan government of blocking their investigations. Mr. Kenyatta has maintained his innocence, and the government said it complied with prosecution demands. Judge Fernandez ordered the lower court to reconsider its decision not to report Kenya to the ICC's governing body for noncompliance. In Nairobi, Amnesty International's East Africa campaigner, Victor Odero, reacted cautiously, saying the rights group is waiting for the trial court's reconsideration of its ruling.
Amnesty International's position, of course, is that states have to respect and abide by the obligations under international human rights law. And this is, in fact, the matter that is to be determined, whether or not Kenya, in the first instance, abided by its obligations under the statute.
The ICC has made non-compliance referrals to the governing body before, including on cases dealing with Sudan, Chad, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. That body can then impose sanctions, but so far has not done so. Kenya's deputy president, William Ruto, is still on trial at the ICC on charges similar to those against Mr. Kenyatta. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis, ICG Director Thierry Verculon says. Continuing retaliation between armed groups could lead to greater division within the nation's defense and security forces. The military has largely been disengaged from the recent violence but Verculon says ethnic tension within the army may be resurfacing. His comments were made in an interview published online by Bujumbura Radio Bonsha after the assassination of Colonel Jean Bikomagu, the former chief of defense staff, and Lieutenant General Adolphe Nshimirimana, the former head of intelligence. He says it's obvious those assassinations are acts of retaliation from one camp against the other, and that the country is slipping towards conflict. Burundi has been rocked by violence since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced in April he would seek another term. He denied he was seeking a third term because he was initially elected by Parliament and not voters.
In related news, the new president of SADC, the Southern Africa Development Community, says he's against African leaders staying in power too long. Botswana President Ian Khama succeeds Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe as SADC chairman. He says, in his opinion, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza has served two terms. Khama says that at the end of the day, once you sit in the office and assume all the functions of that office, you are serving your term. Also, a coalition of Burundi opposition groups have urged the president to resign by August 26th to prevent further violence. The call comes from the National Council for the Respect of the Arusha Agreement for Peace and Reconciliation in Burundi and the Restoration of the Rule of Law.
In commemoration of World Humanitarian Day, international agencies are paying tribute to the thousands of humanitarian workers who have lost their lives or been injured in the line of duty. Lisa Schlein reports from UN European Headquarters in Geneva.
In December 2008, the UN General Assembly established World Humanitarian Day on August 19th in memory of the terrorist attack on UN headquarters in the Iraqi capital Baghdad in 2003. 22 UN staff members were killed, including Mission Chief Sergio Vieira de Mello. UN Chief Spokesman in Geneva, Ahmed Fawzi, was de Mello's press secretary. That day is seared in his memory.
It was the beginning of a downward spiral in terms of UN protection and UN humanitarian work, where we realized that we had become a target of terrorism.
Since then, attacks against humanitarian workers responding to emergencies have increased and become all too commonplace. The World Health Organization is launching a campaign to draw attention to continued attacks on healthcare workers and health facilities. WHO reports 603 healthcare workers were killed and 958 injured in direct attacks in 32 countries in 2014 alone. Rudy Connix is coordinator of WHO's Department of Emergency Risk Management and Humanitarian Response. He says healthcare workers and facilities are under regular and constant attack in areas of conflict.
Just recently, in Yemen, for example, 30 hospitals have been attacked. 14 healthcare workers have been injured. 5 of them have been killed. But it's not only in Yemen. In Syria, in Iraq, in Central African Republic, in Ukraine, in South Sudan, today, hospitals are attacked and healthcare workers risk their lives to do what healthcare workers do, provide services, provide health to people. These attacks must stop.
But it is not only in areas of conflict where the lives of healthcare workers are at risk. WHO notes in West Africa, more than half of the 875 health workers infected with Ebola have died. Health workers were among several people killed by villagers in Guinea while trying to raise awareness about this deadly disease. The number of polio cases globally has been reduced by 99%, but this achievement has come at a great cost. WHO reports more than 100 health workers have been attacked trying to eradicate polio. 32 have been killed in Pakistan while trying to provide vaccines to young children at risk of contracting this crippling disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Arab League urges member states to come to the military aid of Libya's Tobruk regime. It's fighting against extremists who are fighting in eastern Libya as affiliates of the Islamic State. The League fell short of a full commitment to Libya in the emergency summits yesterday. However, they agreed to meet next week to discuss the formation of a joint Arab force to intervene in regional crises and combat terrorism. Libyan Foreign Minister Mohamed Al-Dari told League diplomats that Libya is bleeding. He warned that his ill-equipped government is not able to fight off the Islamic State. Al-Dari says the extremists are seeking to establish a base in Libya as the U.S. led airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Libya has slipped into political division and militant chaos since the 2011 NATO-backed uprising that ended the rule of Muammar Gaddafi. Libya has been under a UN arms embargo since then. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Higgs Weeb, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And the International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
It is estimated there are 22 million unsafe abortions every year, resulting in 22,000 deaths. A new study looks at the global cost of unsafe abortions, including the many women who are treated for complications of botched procedures. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Guttmacher Institute says unsafe abortion accounts for up to 15% of maternal deaths every year. What's more, 7 million women annually are treated at medical facilities after complications set in. The Institute is a nonprofit organization that says it aims to advance sexual and reproductive health and rights through research, policy analysis, and public education. Its study is based on health statistics and scientific studies from 26 developing countries. Dr. Sushila Singh is the lead author of the study, published in BJOG, an international journal of obstetrics and gynecology. She describes how the procedure can be unsafe.
That means that the woman either went to a provider who is not trained to provide this service, not formally trained, doesn't have the right skills, or she goes to a place that is unhygienic. So there is a risk of infection, even if the person is trained.
She says unsafe abortions can be performed by a variety of people in different settings.
It could be a midwife, informal midwife, a trained birth attendant at the lower end of the qualification scale. And it could even be a nurse, a trained nurse, or an MD, but they may not have the training to do the abortion, or they're doing it under conditions that aren't very hygienic.
Dr. Singh says the report's findings provide further evidence about the number of women who suffer injury as a result of complications due to unsafe abortion, often leading to chronic disability.
Extreme hemorrhage, a lot of bleeding, up to a perforation of a uterus or an infection that is leads to a high-grade fever, sepsis even, lacerations, and depending on if a woman inserts an object into her vagina. There are different categories of complications from the less severe up to the most severe and life-threatening.
The study says the annual cost of treating women for complications of unsafe abortions is $232 million. But that's just for those who actually go for treatment. The study estimates the cost for treating all the women who actually need it would be more than $560 million.
The quality of the care for the $232 million is what are they getting right now, which is not as WHO recommends such care should be. We all know that the quality of care varies a lot across the world. Perhaps it's not that the country or the government or the provider doesn't want to give good quality care, but they may not have the training or the facilities, the capacity to do it.
The findings, she says, show the importance of prevention for women.
Better contraceptive counseling and services, a better range of choice of methods, follow-up of women if they have a problem with a method to offer them something else. This set of services at a good quality would help women to prevent the unintended pregnancy in the first place which would avoid having to resort to an abortion.
Dr. Singh says good quality medical care is a must for women suffering complications from unsafe abortions. Delaying treatment could mean death.
The fact is that safe abortion services, the availability and accessibility of these would prevent the situation also.
The Guttmacher Institute study says the highest rate for treatment for unsafe abortion is in Pakistan. The lowest is in Brazil. Regionally, the highest rate is in Asia, primarily South Central Asia, followed by Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Dr. Singh says debate and controversy over abortion is widespread, in part because of the stigma often associated with the procedure. But she says many women will seek an abortion out of desperation over an unintended pregnancy, even though there are laws banning or restricting it. She says reproductive rights can be subject to the political climate within a country. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The final report has been released evaluating progress made in reaching the Millennium Development Goals for reducing maternal deaths. The MDGs, which were backed by the UN and end this year, aimed to reduce maternal mortality by three quarters. The study says many countries have reduced deaths by half. However, the Global Women's Health Organization and Gender Health says efforts must continue to limit reproductive injuries that put mothers at risk, such as obstetric fistula. They say the condition ruins a woman's chances of having a livelihood, raising a healthy family, and contributing to her community. And it argues that ending fistula means eradicating obstructed labor. The still high numbers of women with obstetric fistula signify that much work needs to be done in addressing maternal health care. Dr. Lori Romanzi is project director for Fistula Care Plus, a project of Engender Health. She says obstetric fistula is part of a long list of problems suffered by women and their newborns as a result of obstructed labor. Fistula is a hole that develops between the vagina and the rectum or bladder. As a result, affected women secrete urine and feces.
The relationship between fistula and maternal mortality is simply that obstructed labor often kills women. But if it does not kill the woman, then she will have any number of morbidities, only one of which is obstetric fistula. She can also have severe internal scarring that makes sexual relations impossible. She can have infertility, nerve damage that makes it impossible for her to walk properly. Then there is all the psychological sequelae. A lot of them have what is, in essence, a post-traumatic stress disorder. They're mourning very often the loss of a stillborn baby. They have anxiety, depression, difficulty concentrating, and this can persist even after they have been treated for the fistula condition and successfully so.
Dr. Romanzi emphasized that fistula ruins a woman's life because she is often ostracized by the community or her family for odorous leakages of bodily waste.
Here in the U.S., incontinence is either the number one or number two reason to admit someone to nursing home. There's no human community anywhere in the world that finds living with a constantly incontinent person to be something that's easily tolerated. In poor countries, women who have become constantly incontinent as a result of fistula don't have the option to be warehoused into a community, so they're often simply ostracized by their community. About 40 to 50% of them are divorced. What I find remarkable about that statistic is that we've got about half of the husbands not divorcing their wives, and I think those men deserve to be acknowledged and applauded for continuing to support the mother of their children.
Dr. Romanzi identified two groups of women who develop fistula in terms of obstetric indicators. The largest of the two groups are mature women who have given birth four or five times and for whatever reason are now having problems during childbirth. Often the baby is stuck.
There are many reasons for this. She could have some untreated, undiagnosed gestational diabetes, making the baby quite large. She might have a twin pregnancy this time. That's more common as women get older. Also, newborn weight tends to simply be a little bit larger with each subsequent pregnancy. As women get past the mark of having had five babies, the babies are also more prone to be in a strange position, what's called transverse lie, where the baby is sideways. This can lead to obstructed labor.
The other group of women includes those who develop fistula with their first baby, even though the young mother may have waited until her late teens or early 20s to have children.
There is this, what I call the poster child of fistula, is the 12-year-old child bride who gets pregnant before she has her first menses and has an obstructed labor while she's still a small child, possibly of stunted growth due to poor nutrition. And while that's true, that group, which gets all the attention in the lay press, is actually a very small component of the total group of women who actually survive obstructed labor and come in with a fistula.
The main message Dr. Romanzi takes from the experiences of afflicted women is that ending fistula means ending obstructed labor. Equally important, she says, is there is no safe way to give birth without having a skilled birth attendant, such as a midwife or doctor, or being at a proper medical center.
This is something that's missing from a lot of literature. You read in the public, people want to feel very sorry for these poor women and all the tragedy they face, and they want to act like it's something that happens over there, when in actuality, obstructed labor happens every day, everywhere. In high-income countries, it is a significant contributor to our cesarean section rate.
And Gender Health has been working for decades to improve reproductive health systems for both women and men. Dr. Romanzi says access to reliable contraception is the key to reducing the risk of fistula.
And Gender Health, which was originally founded some decades ago, with the sole purpose of improving access to family planning and birth control methods. As it expanded globally, this remained a core component of the activity. And wherever we are working with women suffering fistula and fistula programs, we are also working to make sure that the delivery mechanism is executed to a global standard.
And Gender Health has offered gender equity improvement programs that include men as partners. These programs help men understand what women go through when they are in labor. They also help them recognize danger signs so mothers at risk can get medical care as soon as possible, despite some traditional and cultural beliefs that women should have their babies at home. I'm Kim Lewis, reporting from Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sadi, coming up at 1830 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete's second five-year term is nearly over. On October 25th, the nation's voters head to the polls to choose a leader. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth discussion on the Tanzanian elections and the role of the opposition in the upcoming vote. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent, old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.